Good morning. Welcome to the House Committee on Higher Education, Innovation, and Workforce Development. We appreciate being here. It's Wednesday, March 4th. We have an interesting topic today on open educational resources. I'm going to open an informational hearing and invite our special guest, Cable Green, forward, please. As you're getting settled, I'll tell the committee that we're very fortunate and thankful to Chemeketa. The nice coincidence that you were here to interact with them, and we're glad to kind of grab that opportunity and appreciate your willingness to inform us as well. When I talked to a couple of community college presidents and asked the what might be on the top of the list of things that the committee and the legislature might do, it wasn't much of a delay before they quickly and consistently talked about textbooks and open educational resources. So we're glad you're here. Your reputation precedes you, and we're eager to hear from you.
Thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee. My name is Cable Green. I'm the Director of Global Learning at Creative Commons, and it'll become more clear what those things are in just a moment. I'd invite you to please interrupt me, ask questions as we're going through this. I have several slides, and I'll move quickly through them, but please do ask questions along the way, and if we need to hop out to the web to look at something to answer your questions, we can certainly do that as well. So first, just a bit of level setting to make the point that the students in the state of Oregon and everywhere else in the United States are under tremendous pressure, financial pressure and otherwise, as they're trying to get an education. These numbers essentially show the bottom line here is the consumer price index over the last decade. Red line is the increased cost of college textbooks. The blue line, top line there, is tuition and fees have gone up 89%, 82%, 28%. So you can see what's happened to the cost of textbooks. This chart essentially shows, if you look on the left, it's the billions of dollars of student debt. So these are, go up to 2012, and you can see we're approaching $1 trillion in student debt in the United States. And then the red line shows what the median income of somebody with a bachelor's degree looks like. You can see that line is going down, that trend and continues today. These are outdated numbers. These are 2013 numbers. Student debt had topped $1.2 trillion. This is more than all of the consumer debt in the United States. So all the credit card debt in the U.S. is less than student debt. And you probably know that student debt is one of those few debts that you may not discharge in bankruptcy court. So you can get rid of your home loan, your mortgage loan. You can be forgiven in many other parts of your financial life, but your student debt sticks with you forever. Net effect of this is you've got students in Oregon that are coming out with high debt loads, and they're not able to be full participants in your economy. So they can't buy cars, they can't buy houses, they can't start families because they're saddled with significant debt. The numbers, if you look here, are now approaching $27,000, the average debt for a bachelor's student when they come out. Student default rates, because, of course, it's still difficult to find jobs, although the job market is improving. And we are seeing some improvements in student loan defaults, but it's still right up around 14% of students that take out loans from the U.S. federal government are defaulting. You're familiar with this trend. These are national numbers, but state funding for public higher education continues to go down. Tuition continues to go up. All of these factors together are putting a squeeze on students, right? They've got higher tuition, et cetera. But we're here to talk and focus a bit on textbooks. These are some of the highest enrolled textbooks and courses in every community college and university in the state of Oregon. This is also true globally. Here's what it looks like. So an introduction to physics book. This is a physics 101 textbook, a very popular one. Lots of different ways to access the book. You can rent it, you can buy it, you can buy it used, you can get an ebook, etc. If you want to buy it new, you're up around $240. But the publishers will tell you, hey, good news, you can lease access. You can rent the book, and $103 is a lot less. But what they don't like to talk about is that there are time bombs on these resources. So it's like a car. When you stop paying the lease fee, you lose access. In the case of educational resources, at the time that you stop paying the fee, 180 days, which oftentimes is less than the end of your course, you lose access to the educational resources, which you need to be successful in your course. Not to mention the fact that I just took pre-algebra, and now I'm going into algebra or pre-calc, and I'm moving into calc, and those resources are gone. So if I'm in calculus and I'm going to look back at my pre-calc materials, I don't have access to them anymore. And if I want access, I have to pay again. And so this is the problem, the market problem we're moving into in not only higher education, but also in K-12. And that is that we're taking educational resources away from the learners, from our students, and they lose access when they stop paying. I think everybody's seen this movie, right? They wipe your memory.
Yep.
This is the new, sorry about the number being shifted down. This is the new average spend of books and supplies for community colleges and universities in the United States. So students are spending $1,328 on books.
Per year or per term?
Per year.
Okay.
These are annual costs. I'll ask the community colleges. Tuition at Chemeketa is for full-time students?
About $4,500 a year.
About $4,500 a year.
Most of the time.
Add on to that $1,328. So why is this a problem? Why do we care about this? Well, there are a couple of market failures. One is that there's been consolidation in the market, so we're seeing a lack of competition, so we've got very high costs and limited supply. But frankly, this is the real market problem, and that is that textbooks are one of the few markets in the world where the consumer doesn't get to choose what they're buying. So in the case of textbooks, the faculty member, the professor, chooses the book, but the professor doesn't have to pay for the book. So if I'm in your class and I want to be a full participant to be successful, I have to buy the book that you've assigned, but whether or not I don't get to choose the book or the cost, I don't get to comparison shop. I have to buy it. And that is having some seriously problematic effects. This is a Florida study. There's been a study in California and recently a national study, and they all show the same thing, that because textbook costs are high and because students are sick of going back to the bookstore and getting 10 cents on the dollar when they sell their used books back, or oftentimes bookstores say, I'm sorry, we can't buy it back because the editions have changed, this is the net result. So 67% of students are not purchasing the textbooks which have been assigned for their class. And if you ask any faculty member in Oregon, they will say, yes, I've had this experience. Most of my students are not buying at least one of the educational resources I've assigned. 50% of the students are taking fewer classes. You all know that one of the things we want to do in Oregon is get to four-year completion on a bachelor's degree. This is one of the reasons why you're not there, is that students are taking fewer courses because they can't afford to take another course at the community college or at the university because textbook costs are expensive. 31% are choosing not to register for a course because of high textbook costs. So I'd really like to take that course, but the textbooks are too expensive, so I'm going to delay my degree or choose a different major or something.
What's the difference there between the 50% and the 31%? Take fewer courses, choose not to register.
So the 50% is just an overall aggregate. I can't afford to take three courses because my textbooks are so expensive, so I'm going to take two courses instead. The 31% is I really want to take Engineering 101, and I'd like to be a STEM major, but I can't afford engineering textbooks. And so it's a subject-specific number.
Okay.
Right. People are going without textbooks. People are dropping courses. They're withdrawing from courses because they don't have books. So during that add drop period, I'm making a risk assessment about whether or not I think I can be successful in this course. And if the textbooks are expensive and I'm electing not to buy it, I know that I'm less likely to be successful in this course. That's going to make me more likely to drop out. Okay, so it's having all these negative effects. And from an educator's standpoint, professors are starting to ask this, right, how are my students supposed to learn with materials they can't afford and they're not buying? And it's very frustrating for faculty because they spend a lot of time designing the instruction materials for their students to be successful, and then the students are not buying the materials. So that's the current status quo. It's not very good, and it's not serving your students well. Now, so that's the bad news. Here's the good news, and I'll whip through these very quickly. There are a new set of tools in the 21st century, and we've had these for roughly 15 years, that we've never had before in the history of humanity or education. So this is, I don't mean to overstate this, but it's a very exciting time. So knowledge is magical, right? I can give knowledge to you without giving it away. It's the old Jefferson quote, I can light your candle without mine going out. Physical expressions are not magical in the sense that if I want to give you a paper book, I have to give it away to you and I no longer have it. When expressions are digital, they also become, they have this magical quality. So if I take your newspaper from your doorstop, you don't have a newspaper anymore. Although if we're both reading the Statesman Journal online, a million people can read it simultaneously, and there's no rivalrous resource there. We can both access it at the same time. As simple as this sounds, and we all use the internet, think about it in terms of education. This is a really exciting advance. For both knowledge and expressions, we can give them without giving them away. This is develops this unprecedented capacity in education to share as we never have before, so we can educate as we never have before. So what does share mean in a digital world online? Well, it means that you can copy and distribute of digital files. In education, not only do we want to copy and distribute, but we want to adapt and edit. We want somebody else's educational resources to be useful for us. So MIT, we all familiar with MIT, for a decade they've given away all 2,100 courses at MIT for free under an open license, and I'll come to that in a minute. But Chemeketa can take all of MIT's courses for free and legally edit them and use any of them that they want without even asking permission. So when things are digital, we can edit for free, we can share, we can educate as never before. Here's what the numbers look like. So take an average 250-page textbook. These are all the different things you can do if you're copying the book. Believe it or not, you can still copy by hand. You can pay somebody. I would not recommend it. It's very expensive. But the number I want you to look at is this copy by computer, right? Because of cloud computing, the falling cost of disk space, the falling cost of bandwidth, we can actually make copies of a textbook for 0.00084 cents. So for the amount of money you have in your wallet, in your pocket, we could make copies of a Stats 101 open textbook for all students in the state of Oregon. Right? These are the kind of economics that we're talking about. Cost of distribution, very, very similar, right? 0.00072. And these numbers continue to fall. Why? Well, because it doesn't cost anything for me to share my digital file with everybody in the state or everybody on the planet, for that matter. So the question for us as educators, this is where open educational resources comes from, is when copy, distribution, storage, and editing become free, what do we do with those capabilities as educators, right? Now, that's very exciting, but the problem is that there's this thing called copyright, which gets in our way, right? And so copyright cancels these possibilities because, of course, copyright says you cannot make copies without permission. You cannot edit without permission. You cannot redistribute without permission. Copyright forbids those things. So it's a bit like having, you know, an F-15 Eagle fighter, which is capable of some amazing things, and saying you may only drive on Oregon's highways. I-5 is it, right? You drive your fighter up and down I-5. And that's a bit what we're doing today with educational resources, because we've got these tremendous abilities with the internet and with things being digital and the technical capabilities to edit and share at the marginal cost of zero, but copyright forbids this. So what do we do? Well, this is where I work. I work at Creative Commons. We're a global nonprofit. And to be clear, I'm not here to sell you anything. All this stuff is free. We exist to make it easy and simple for the world to share copyrighted resources when the author chooses to do so. And so before Creative Commons, you had the public domain. For stuff to get in the public domain, representative McKeon would have to first, no offense, die, and then 70 years would have to go by before her works go into the public domain. Well, if you're an educator and you want to share on Tuesday, that's an unfortunate set of circumstances, right? I'd rather not die and wait 70 years. I'd rather share with you. On the other end of the spectrum, we've got all rights reserved copyright, which is good. Copyright's a good thing. It protects the rights of the author. But the problem was there was nothing in between. So what about the professor? What about the institution? What about the state that wants to maintain copyright, don't give up your intellectual property, and share under an open license with the world under the conditions that you choose? That's Creative Commons. So our licenses, there are different options. Attribution means you got to give people credit when you use their stuff. Share alike means when you change their textbook, you have to share your changes forward under the same license terms. Non-commercial, you can't sell it. No derivatives, you can't change it. And so when you mix and match those different conditions, you get one of six open copyright licenses. This is what the world uses to share. Google just gave us these numbers. What Google can see is that there are about 882 million Creative Commons licensed works out there in the world, but Google said it's probably closer to a billion plus because their stats aren't very good. Here's who's sharing. Here's where they're sharing. It's happening all over the planet. The U.S. is out in front. And there are big projects around the world. You've probably heard of this small thing called Wikipedia. Everything on Wikipedia has a CC license on it. Flickr, huge image database. There are something like 200, 300 million images on Flickr that are openly licensed. CERN, where they're figuring out how the universe works by smashing together atoms. They just discovered the Higgs boson, or confirmed the Higgs boson theory. Everything that they produce, they're putting out under Creative Commons licenses. And the main reason is that they're physicists. They're scientists. They realize they don't have all the smart people. There's some really great physicists here at the University of Oregon and at Oregon State. And they want those physicists to be able to help solve these problems. The only way to do that is to get the information out in real time so that they can figure out how all these particle physics work. These ideas of the internet, things being digital and open licensing, you put all those together and now you get to have conversations about spending a lot of money to build a high-quality educational resource, spending a lot of money to keep it updated. But if it's digital, we can share with everybody, not only in the state, but around the planet, at the marginal cost of zero. So the question for education for a decade has been, what do we do with those tools? Because quite literally today, we can spend $1 million and build an amazing intro to physics textbook, and we can share it with everybody for nothing. And so universities are doing it. There are 200 to 300 universities around the planet that have just opened their doors and said, here, take this. So MIT was the first, but many others have followed suit. So if you go to, if you like chemistry, go to UC Irvine, you'll see the entire chemistry department puts all of their works online. If you want to see an aggregate of this, go to the Open Education Consortium, you'll see all the universities around the planet that are sharing. And why are they sharing? For a lot of reasons. One is they're educators. Education's about sharing. That's what we do. We share resources, and that's part of their mission. Two, it's good for their brand, right? Everybody uses MIT OpenCourseWare. That's good for MIT. They actually drives more students to them. This is also happening at K-12, including in your state. Congratulations to your Department of Education. They've actually joined a national effort to work on OER for K-12, and I'll come back to that. So we've thrown around this term, open educational resources, but let's be specific about what we mean. OER is all the stuff we use in education, the teaching, learning, and research materials, and it has to have two characteristics. One is it must be free, meaning there's no costs. Somebody's not charging for it. And two, the user has to have the legal rights to do what we call the 5 R's. You have to be able to reuse it, use it exactly as it is, revise it, modify it to meet your needs, remix it, take a little bit of that MIT OpenCourseWare, a little bit of that Chemeketa course, a little bit of Washington's Open Course Library courses, which is all openly licensed, and create something new. Redistribute, I want to build it once, and I'm going to share it with all the colleges and universities in the state, and retain. You're not going to rip resources out of students' hands like the publishers are now doing. You're going to say to your learners in Oregon, we value you as a learner, and we want you to build a library of resources that you can keep forever. We're not going to take resources away from you. By the way, you do this in your K-12 schools in Oregon as well. When students leave fourth grade, you take all their educational resources away from them because you have to amortize the cost of those resources over a decade so that you can afford them in the state. And then when they go to fifth grade, they don't have any of their resources with them. It's a common practice. Doesn't make any sense in a world where we can share for the marginal cost of zero. So what the internet and the technology enables, OER actually permits. And so we can get that plane that was stuck on I-5, we can get it in the air and we can actually take advantage. And here are some of the advantages, right? When you have OER, other people can translate it. Oregon, like I live in Washington and Olympia just up the road, you have a large migrant community which moves through your state because of the agricultural sector, as do we. A lot of these students speak Spanish as their first language. When your course is OER, somebody can translate it into Spanish. They've got the legal rights to make the translation. Accessibility, we're all subject to 508 guidelines, which says if somebody walks into your class and they have a physical or other disability, you have to serve them. There are a lot of nonprofits out there that will take OER and make it more accessible than it is. If you're faculty, you care about customization. At Chemeketa, if I'm faculty, I want to make sure that I have all the legal rights to create exactly what I need for my students because I know the economic and business environment around Salem. I know where my students are going to get jobs in Oregon, and I want to be able to customize the educational resources accordingly. If they're buying textbooks from the big publishers, I mean, with all due respect, the publishers do not care about Oregon. You're too small. You're not Texas or California or New York State. When your faculty here in the state ask for changes to textbooks, the publishers just don't care. You're not big enough. You're not a big enough market. With open educational resources, your faculty in Oregon can say, hey, we have the legal rights. We'll modify it to meet our needs for the University of Oregon, for Oregon State, et cetera. And affordability, we saw what students are facing. How much do open educational resources cost? Zero. Right. They cost a lot to build. They cost something to maintain. But once those costs are covered, those fixed costs are covered, the marginal cost, the flexible costs of sharing are zero. When they're digital. Print on demand, if students want print, they don't have a digital device, you're looking at about $3 or $4 for a textbook as opposed to the average cost of about $150. Okay, so does this stuff exist? Well, yes, it does. This is a major project out of Rice University in Texas. This is called OpenStax. They spend upwards of $600,000 building these books and then about $100,000 a year keeping them up to date.
$600,000 aggregate across all those? Or
no, each book.
Okay.
Wow. So they spend, these are designed to go head-to-head with publisher textbooks. And if you look at the titles, these are the highest enrolled courses in your education institutions. They also happen to be everybody else's highest enrolled courses. Right. So their goal with this project is to build out in phase one the top 25 highest enrolled textbooks with all the supplemental resources around them, sample quizzes, PowerPoints, everything that faculty want and need for their classes. They're giving them all away for free, and they're putting a Creative Commons attribution license on all of them, which means that your Oregon faculty could take all these today and modify them if they chose to do so, change the order around, throw away what they don't want, write in new sections, and all of a sudden their textbook is free for their course. Who's paying for this? Foundations. Rice University is putting money into this, and they've got individual donations coming in as well.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Your comment, it's up to the professor. The professor has to agree to do this. You go back to one of your earlier charts. This whole cost thing is driven by what the professor decides.
That's correct.
So the challenge to us and the leadership of our universities is to tell those deans to do this.
You're absolutely right. In higher education...
No disrespect, Dr. Guy.
So you're absolutely right. In higher education, the decision point lies with the faculty member. And as I'm sure you've been told, we have something called academic freedom in higher education where the faculty choose what the faculty choose to use. My experience, and we see this globally, the way to get faculty to move to open educational resources is to provide support for them. And I'll let the colleges talk about what kind of support would be most useful for them. But in Washington State, my last job was I worked for the community colleges of Washington State, ran all the online learning for the system for the 34 colleges, 500,000 students, and open education. What we did was we simply said, folks, we have a problem. We said to the faculty, here's how much textbooks cost. Students aren't buying them. They're not prepared. They're graduating with a lot of debt. Who wants to come help solve this problem? So completely voluntary. Nobody was forced to do anything. And then we said to the faculty, if you want to help solve the problem, what we can do for you is provide release time. So that costs money, right? You have to buy out some of their time and replace them with a different adjunct faculty member usually. But it wasn't a lot of money. Our legislature in Washington put up $750,000. The Gates Foundation matched it with another $750,000, so we had $1.5 million. And with that $1.5 million, we redesigned the entire general education curriculum, our highest enrolled 81 courses, and we moved all of them to OER. So is $1.5 million a lot of money? Yeah, but we were spending $141 million annually on textbooks for those courses. So in that sense, it wasn't a lot of money.
Representative McEwen has a question, too.
Thank you, Chair Reed. I'm trying to get my head wrapped around this. This is fascinating stuff you're talking about, and I really appreciate you being here to educate us. What if you end up in a situation in an institution where you have somebody teaching macroeconomics in classroom A and somebody teaching macroeconomics in classroom B, and this professor chooses to go this route and this professor likes the materials that he's used to and wants to use? Do you have a disadvantaged professor then? Because it's going to cost the student more to attend this guy's class than this guy's class.
Yeah, and that's a good thing.
How do you reconcile that?
And that is a good thing because the market should be able to work. And so what you want to do, this is always my recommendation to universities and colleges, is they, in their course catalog, where students get the information about the courses and when the courses are, et cetera, they should mark the courses that where they've driven the cost of textbooks to zero with open educational resources by putting a little OER or a dollar symbol with a down arrow or however you want to mark it, but signal to students. And then what students do, quite frankly, is they vote with their feet, and the faculty members that don't have OER very quickly move to OER. It's a great incentive tool.
Yes, please.
But I think back to my original question, does that disadvantage a professor who chooses not to use this you're driving them to a curriculum. I'm being the devil's advocate here. You're almost eliminating a choice for a student to take a professor's course that may be a little bit different than what this, what are we going to call it, the average curriculum turns out to be that's driven by this.
So it's an excellent point.
Am I missing something here?
Just one important point. So the important point that I had, and this is my fault, I haven't been clear, is that OER should never be mandated, and it's not about having a statewide or a nationwide curriculum. It's actually quite the opposite. So yes, these books are free, and they've been well designed, et cetera. But if somebody wants to, for, say, Intro to Sociology, for example, there I could show you 5 or 6 really good Intro to Sociology open textbooks that were all free, and they're all designed very differently. And they all have a Creative Commons license on them, which means that Faculty X could take parts of each one and develop a new textbook, or, frankly, they could write their own resources. The pressure that's being put on the faculty member that hasn't moved to OER isn't to adopt that book. The pressure is from the students to say, how can you reduce the cost of instructional materials in your class, because I'm going to Chemeketa and I'm low income and I'm just trying to afford college, right?
And so I am going to vote with my feet.
And you're going to vote with your
broke
feet.
Broke students going to vote with their feet.
They absolutely will. And so the yes, that's pressure. Is it unfair? I would say that in this age, it's the responsibility of all faculty to look globally for the best content that's out there that others are willing to give away for free. And that as a faculty member, part of my responsibility is to find those best materials, and we should help them and support them. And in fact, there's an OER librarian at Chemeketa who helps faculty find the resources they're looking for, and then help faculty design exactly what they want. So we should never put faculty in a position where we're jamming a particular book or other resource down their throat. It's quite the opposite. This is more choice as opposed to less choice. To be honest, what they have today with the publishers is less choice because the faculty can't modify it. Right? You take it as it is.
You see.
Representative Gagos and then Representative Reardon.
Yeah, I would just say, Representative McEwen, that I think there's a number of different other market sort of measures for students. I think, for example, courses are always evaluated at the end, and students, if you ever look up, what is it, Grade Your Professor, something like that.
Grade Your Professor.
So, I mean, students really do look at that. They also know who the good professors are. I mean, I think that what we need really is, and I appreciate this tremendously, I think we need an edge globally. I mean, we really need to find any advantages that we can, and this seems to offer an advantage. I think, again, we have a lot of different measures for students to understand where to go in terms of getting a good instructor and taking a good course. So, I taught a seminar in psychology recently, and the textbook was $250. I mean, it was just absurd. I mean, I'll never do that again, never. I really felt terrible ordering that book and having students buy that thing. But
now you know you could do it again and have some other options.
Yeah, that's right. We have other options for you now. I'll give you my card, and I'll help you find Intro to Psych books.
Yeah.
Representative McEwen, is yours
specific
with this? Okay.
I guess, and when I characterize this, we're in a transition now. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is we're at point A now. We're going to move to point B, and these options are going to continue to grow. I mean, we're at the very beginnings of this.
Actually, we're 10 years in.
My question may be moot because in a few years this is going to change.
So I think it's fair to say that in the next 3 to 5 years, you will see the top 150 to 200 courses with robust OER options. Part of my job is when I work with governments around the world, including the U.S. federal government, and governments are putting open licensing requirements on discretionary grants, and I'll show you what that looks like in a moment. I ask them to require the CC BY license, the Creative Commons Attribution, which is our least restrictive license. And the reason I'm doing that is I want Oregon's faculty to have the maximum degrees of freedom to modify, change, remix those materials to meet Oregon's needs. So, yeah, it's
Thank you.
It is changing.
And just before you get started again, Representative Reardon.
Oh, just a short question. I love the added, you know, flexibility, lower cost, and all of that. Is there any objective review that would compare these materials that are created at a university with what the publishers have provided in the past? Are we giving up anything in terms of quality?
That's a great question. In fact, these are this is a publishing house. So the people that run OpenStax are actually former Pearson editors and publishers. So what we've so to be totally frank, the Open Educational Resources movement was the world's big foundations: Hewlett, Gates, Ford, Helmsley, you name it. Basically, looked at the textbook market and said, "This is nuts." You all in education are fundamentally not taking advantage of things being digital, open licensing, et cetera. And what's it going to take to allow students to be successful? So if you look at Gates, for example, Gates has a goal of helping low-income students from ages 18 to 26 get a college credential that's going to lead to a high-paying job. That's their main focus on education. That's an impossible task when textbooks cost $1,400 a year, right? Students just can't get there. Hewlett, same thing. So it's, you know, even though $600,000 is a lot of money, the textbook market in the United States for higher education alone is between $8 and $10 billion a year. Right? It doesn't cost $8 to $10 billion to build the best resources. So to answer your question specifically, there are robust quality review processes, just like at any other publisher's editorial processes, for the big OER projects, OpenStax included. The other part of that answer, and they're designed to go head-to-head in a quality challenge with publisher materials. And the OER community has actually developed rubrics, quality review rubrics, that are more robust than what the publishers ever put on their own materials. And we hand those to faculty and to colleges, and we say, please don't take our word for that these are high quality. Don't take the publisher's word that their content is high quality. Here's a robust rubric for determining quality, and use your own if you want. But you, the faculty, you, Chemeketa, you, Oregon State, you are the arbiters of what's high quality. Don't trust us and don't trust them. You decide. And what's happening is what they're finding is that, you know, I can spend a lot of money for a textbook, and I might view it as low quality, or I might have an expensive textbook that's high quality. I also might find OER that's free, that's very high quality, and I'm going to find OER that's low quality. And so ultimately, quality is not only in the eye of the beholder, it's the local faculty, but it's also, frankly, the correct fit. So what I mean by that is, are MIT's courses high quality? Most people would say, yeah. Are they appropriate for students at Chemeketa? Probably not. Right? It's just at a different level. It's a wrong fit. And so if you're going to take MIT's curriculum, you're going to have to modify it for a community college audience. That's a quality issue as well. I don't know if I answered your question,
but
we talk about quality a lot.
Yeah, that's great.
So one of the representatives asked about adoption. How do you get faculty actually to adopt this? So there's a great project happening at the University of Minnesota right now where they bring faculty in for 2 hours of a training session. Here's what OER is. Here's where you find open textbooks, et cetera. Here's how you adopt them. And after a two-hour training session, they're getting 36% conversions of University of Minnesota faculty. They've now taken this Big Ten wide, and they're also moving into the SEC. So they're working with all the big universities in the state with. See if we can get them out to the Pac 10 later on.
Oh, Pac 12.
And if you want these folks to come out, they'll come out on their own dime, and they're happy to come.
Pac 12.
Sorry, Pac 12. And I should know better. I live in the Northwest. And they're also asking, to your question about quality, they're asking the faculty to review the books for quality. And when the faculty take the two-hour course and review, they're getting 66% conversions. So it actually isn't a very heavy lift to get faculty to understand and then adopt, but you've got to provide a little bit of training. You actually should be very proud. There's an Oregon company that's headquartered in Portland called Lumen Learning, which is specifically designed to help institutions build and adopt OER. And this is a for-profit company, and I usually don't pitch any companies, but the reason that I do recommend these guys is that everything that they build with colleges, they put under an open license. So if Chemeketa wanted to hire this Oregon company to help them build out a degree program for OER, Lumen Learning would say to them, yes, we're happy to do that, but only if everything we build together is under a Creative Commons attribution license so that everybody else in Oregon can use it for free as well. And so it's kind of this social benefit as they work. There's a model program in the United States, which is now being replicated in 50 states. It's called a Z degree, a Z for zero, so zero textbook cost for an entire degree program. This is a business administration degree program. Textbooks used to cost $3,700. They now cost zero. And that's a good thing. And not only have they driven the cost to zero, but 100% of all the materials are available on day one to all students. What does that do? Well, students do better in the classes. They have higher outcomes. They're graduating sooner. The course completion rates are going up. But they've also seen some unexpected things, like they're making more tuition on the courses. Why is that happening? Because during the add drop period, if a student didn't buy books, they're more likely to drop out. And if they drop out during add drop, they don't pay tuition. The university is actually seeing significant, up to 14% higher collections of tuition than they were seeing before, because students aren't dropping out. They're staying in the course because they know they can be successful because they have all their resources. Right? The faculty are extremely excited because they have control over the curriculum for the first time, and they can modify it to meet their specific needs.
Where is Tidewater?
Tidewater's in Virginia, I want to say.
Norfolk.
Yeah. This has been so successful. There have been so many, all the key performance metrics that colleges and universities care about have gotten better when they've gone a whole degree program. Hewlett Foundation is now putting together a $10 million grant fund where community colleges can apply and build their own Z degree programs. We're looking for somebody in Oregon. We'd love to have a Z degree program here.
Great. Representative Gallego has a question.
I do have a question with regard to sort of the companion or what would be called faculty supports or resources, all the bells and whistles that come with published books. I mean, slide presentations, exams, everything. I mean, can you get the same kind of thing with these?
You can, and it comes in two forms. So one is sometimes those packages of here's the book and here's the slide decks and the quiz and everything else. Projects like OpenStax and CK12 for high school are actually putting those packages together for teachers and faculty and saying here's the whole package. What's more common, though, is that if I teach calculus, for example, I'm going to say, well, here's five great open calculus textbooks. I'm going to mix and mash and build exactly what I want. Now I have my textbook. Now I'm going to go to the University of Colorado's FET program, which are simulations for math, because they build the best sims in the world. So I can actually move variables on the screen and see math concepts and physics concepts moving. They're actually, these sims, you know what I mean when I say simulations, right? These simulations are so good. Pearson and McGraw-Hill actually threw away their sims, and they use the sims from this OER project because they're so good. So if I teach calculus, I'm going to bring those sims in. You've probably heard of the Khan Academy. The Khan Academy is, you know, short 7-minute videos on lots of different concepts, including math. I'm going to bring Khan Academy. So it's like being a chef in a kitchen. I'm grabbing some ingredients and I'm going to make a meal. Well, with OER, what you do, and this is why, you know, librarian support is so important, instructional designer support. As faculty, I'm going to pull from lots of different OER repositories and I'm going to bring in exactly what I need. You've probably all seen TED Talks. All TED Talks are under Creative Commons licenses. Faculty bring those into their courses as well. So the answer is yes, and it happens in those two ways. A couple of years ago, California said, you know what? This is a really good idea. Textbooks are too expensive. This General Assembly put out $5 million right out of the general funds budget of California to build open textbooks. Problem was, the publishers got in there, put a rider on the bill so that all the funds had to be matched before they could be released. So far, even though there's $5 million of public money sitting there to do OER, Gates and Hewlett have each put in $500,000 to release the first million of public funds, but there's still $4 million of state funds sitting there. So, you know, something to think about here in Oregon. British Columbia saw that and said, that's a good idea. They've already put $2 to $3 million in, and now Saskatchewan and Alberta are putting public money into funding open educational resources. Just on your northern border, my last job, as I said, was with the community colleges. We had conversations like this. So one thing we haven't said is that, and I don't mean to offend any faculty in the room, but content has become commodity. If you don't believe that, you're not paying attention to the internet. I can find any textbook, I can find educational resources, I can find whatever I need to know on the web for free. And that's just the world we live in, and that's only increasing exponentially daily. And so content is infrastructure for education. You gotta have it. It's like roads, but it's not the reason why somebody goes to Oregon State University, right? They're not gonna go to Oregon State because of the Stats 101 textbook that was selected for Oregon State, right? They go for lots of other reasons, but it's not the textbook or the content that's chosen. So in Oregon, we said, we've got to get rid of our not invented here attitude. It's cocky and arrogant to think that content's not good unless I built it. It's a silly thing to say. I'm a physics professor at Shoreline Community College in Washington, and nobody else can develop good physics content? Probably not so, right? And we need to move to proudly borrowed from there. Proudly borrowed from there means, as faculty, I'm going to grab the best content from around the planet, and I'm going to modify it to meet the needs of my students and the economic environment where my students are going to get jobs. And frankly, we can't afford it. You should run your numbers in the state. My advice to you is to query the higher education system, all the universities and all your community colleges, and ask them for an aggregate list of the top 250 courses and ask for the enrollments for all those courses and the textbook, average textbook cost for each of those courses, and then multiply it out. This was our highest enrolled course in Washington State. We have 60,000 students a year that take English 101. Average cost of the textbook, our students, just in the community colleges, not our seven universities, are spending $10.5 million every year on one set of books for one class. We have over 2,000 classes in our system. These are the kinds of numbers we're talking about. I showed this to our legislature, and this was their response. Are you people insane? And we said, no, but we need your help. And so our response was we built what's called the Open Course Library, which is our highest enrolled 81 courses. It's all OER. We drove the textbook costs between $0 and $30. We gave the faculty a little bit of flexibility, but most of the courses are zero. It's all under a Creative Commons license. If Oregon wants this, take it. It's yours. You don't have to ask permission. You don't have to call anybody. There's no logins or passwords. You just go to this site, download all the courses. It's at opencourselibrary.org. Here's what K-12 looks like. Your K-12, frankly, looks the same. We've got about a million school kids. How many public school kids do you have in the state? You know?
500,000.
500,000? So you probably want to cut these numbers in half. For us, we spend $130 million a year on K-12 textbooks. What we get for that are books that are a decade old on average. Okay? Not good. Paper only, no digital. We're all trying to move to digital, so this is a problem. We tell the students, yeah, learn all your study skills about taking notes, but don't write in your books. And don't customize them, and don't put stickers on them, and don't highlight, and right, so because we got to save them for 10 years. Sorry, thanks for finishing sixth grade. Give all your books back before you go to seventh grade. So we rip the resources out of their hands because, of course, they don't need them as they continue to learn. And they're all rights reserved copyright. So even if our teachers want to update Pluto as a planet because it keeps going back and forth, or update the new, you know, the new geography of the Ukraine, they can't do it because A, it's paper, and B, it's all rights reserved copyright. Right? That's nuts. And so we started a new project, and Oregon's one of the leads on this, called the K-12 OER Collaborative. You're a Common Core state. We're a Common Core state. The 43 states and D.C. and the three territories are on track to spend $8.2 billion collectively over the next 5 years updating two subjects, math and English language arts. That's crazy. Right? So we did back of the napkin, said, you know, for $30, $40 million, we could make it all OER. Because, yeah, it's going to take money to build that stuff. So we're putting out competitive RFPs through the K-12 OER Collaborative. The states, including Oregon, are the governing board of this thing. The states are saying, here's what we want specifically. Here's the content we want. Here's the sequence we want. These are the digital formats we want. Here's how we want it chunked. Here are the resources we want. And the foundations are picking up the tab for this. And then the states are going to be asked to chip in to keep the maintenance going. Already set up a new nonprofit. The states will be the governing board of it.
Great. Representative Wisdom has a question.
Right, but would need the computers too, right? Your amount of money is not.
You could, but not necessarily. You can print OER.
Probably cheaper to get computers.
It's probably cheaper, but you'll have to do that cost-benefit analysis. So yes, if you leave it digital and you're sharing digitally, then the marginal cost of sharing is zero. You want to print a textbook in mass for Oregon schools? You're looking at somewhere between $3 and $4 a book. Now, what we're doing here is we're saying, so if you imagine K-12, think of an Excel spreadsheet, 12 grades, 8 subjects per grade, you got give or take 100 cells. Today in Oregon, for the amount of money you spend on textbooks, your schools are able to fill in 2-3, if they're lucky, of those cells every year. So that's your refresh rate. That's why you're 10 years out of date. That's why we're 10 years out of date. This project says, no, not anymore. We're going to start with math and ELA. They're going to be up to date every single year. We're going to have 5 digital versions for whatever device kids might have. If they don't have a device, we'll print it. That's got a little bit of cost, but much less cost than what we have today. And once we're done with math and ELA, we're going to move to every other subject. If the states don't like what's built, everything's got a Creative Commons attribution license on it, what can you do? Change it. Modify it. But the states are actually on point. So I would be remiss being in a legislature without bringing up policy. So this is another area that we work on quite heavily. This is what academic research funding looks like, and frankly, most of education funding as well. But this is an example of research. U.S. federal government puts out about $80 billion a year for research. University of Oregon, Oregon State pick up a lot of that money to do NIH, NSF research, Department of Education, labor, et cetera. Government gives out money for research to be done. Research gets done. Articles get submitted. Copyright actually gets transferred from the University of Oregon, from the faculty, to the publisher. So now Oregon owns nothing. The U.S. government, the public, owns nothing. The copyright's actually transferred to a public company. Biggest one is called Elsevier. It's in the Netherlands. Nothing against the Dutch. We love the Dutch. But our intellectual property is now offshores. Okay? Articles get published. The libraries, every library in the state has to subscribe. If you don't subscribe, you can't have access. Okay, so you paid for it, but you don't get to have access. Public has little reuse rights. What do you get? Slow scientific progress. The open policy simply says all the government has to do, or foundations, is require an open license when they give money. So the Gates Foundation announced 3 weeks ago they fund a lot of research in global health and malaria and different drug and polio and stuff. All the research they're funding, they're saying you've got to put a Creative Commons attribution license. It's got to be released immediately to the world so everybody can read the research, which is kind of what the whole point of research, right, is people can actually access it and read it and learn. And then the same things happen. You still do the research. You still submit articles. You submit, but now all the libraries in Oregon get free access to the research. Who's paying for this? The same people who pay for it now, governments, foundations. So the money's the same. The process is the same. All they're doing is requiring an open license when they give money. So something to think about as a state legislature is, to the extent that you're giving out optional discretionary grants, right? You have different programs that are initiatives that you launch from time to time. Require a Creative Commons attribution license on those things, because then you can fund something once and all the schools in Oregon can benefit. Pay for it once, everybody uses it. It's a much better use of public money. The White House issued a directive that essentially does this for all the U.S. federal agencies. If you're a U.S. federal agency, you spend more than $100 million on research, you are now required to have an open access policy on all the research that you fund. U.S. Department of Labor put out $2 billion for U.S. community colleges to build academic programs. Everything must have a Creative Commons attribution license on it. Department of Labor said, we're going to fund the national STEM curriculum in Connecticut once, but we want all of Oregon's community colleges to be able to download it and use it if they choose to do so. We don't want to fund it 50 times or 1,000 times, right? There's lots of community colleges in the United States. You fund it once, you put an open license on it, everybody else can use it for free. Kind of makes sense, right? California community colleges got together and they said, from now on, all the entire system, and we have the same policy in Washington State in our community colleges, when we give out grants, everything must have a Creative Commons attribution license on it. You don't like those terms? It's okay. Don't apply for the money. But if you're going to take the public's money, you will share what you build. It's that simple. This is the main point. The default should be that publicly funded resources are openly licensed. If people don't like those terms, don't take the public's money. That's all I've got. I'm happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll have several. At least I will. Who wants to start? Representative Wisden.
I think we're all enthused and appreciate Dr. Green, your presentation, and the chair. I want to support the chair, and we'll introduce a lot of bills to make this happen. I'm also a supporter of copyright and intellectual property rights, and I guess I don't know if we're going to hear from that side of it, too.
Sure.
Is there some way that we can compensate those people, like the musical industry? Is your this book thing, is that, are you looking at the musical industries to try to recover some income for those people who created this data? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I apologize. I should have been more clear. Creative Commons licenses are actually built on top of copyright law, and they are designed, they inherently respect copyright. So when somebody has copyright, they are the only ones that can openly license their work, which makes sense, right? I can't share your textbook that you wrote. Only you can share it because you have the legal rights to do so. So Creative Commons licenses actually enforce copyright law, if you will. So if you use my, if I write a textbook and I have the copyright to it and I choose to put a Creative Commons license on it, legally, several things. One, I still hold copyright. I've not given it up. Two, you are legally bound to follow the license that I've put on my work. So for example, if I put an attribution license on, you have to give me credit in the way I've specified credit. If I put a non-commercial license on it and you sell my work, you put it up on the web for $20, I could actually sue you under U.S. copyright law. I have copyright at my back. So Creative Commons and copyright are actually very good friends. They work hand in hand. If there was no copyright, there'd be no need for Creative Commons. So that's part of the answer. Another part of the answer in terms of revenue and money, that $600,000 for per textbook, that money is going to pay faculty around the United States who are experts in intro to psychology to build those books and to maintain them. And in fact, in the OER space, we pay authors more than commercial publishers pay them. Commercial publishers pay on a royalty system. They tend to pay roughly 10% royalties. The problem with the royalty system is they only make money, the author only makes money on the first sale. And the new model, I talked about how the new model is not to sell books, but to lease books. And so when you are leasing books, when you were selling books, when it goes into the used textbook market, the royalties are gone, right? Because you only make money on the first sale. When you're leasing books, you're charging a lower rate, so the royalties have gone down. In OER, so with the K-12 OER Collaborative, for example, we're saying, hey, $1 million per course, $1 million. Does anybody want to build sixth grade biology? I'll give you $1 million. Do I have any takers? There's a lot of takers, right? We had 41 for-profit companies around the United States that said, I'll do it, right? And we said to them, and we'll give you ongoing maintenance contracts to keep things update. And the for-profit publisher said, I'm in. Now, the Big Five boycotted the RFP because they're trying to show that there's no market for what we're trying to do. All we're trying to do is, this is not an anti-business stance. In fact, quite the opposite. What we're saying is that the public, when we're using public dollars, we need to make sure that we're getting the best product for the best price that meets the needs of our student. And if you think back to the slide I showed on K-12 in Washington, $130 million a year with the results we're getting is not a good buy for the public. It's just not, right? And I said to our legislature, that's how much you're spending and these are the results you're getting. Why don't you put out 100 $1 million RFPs, make them open and competitive. Anybody can reply, right, to build sixth grade biology, et cetera. Do that once and give 25% maintenance contracts. So you're gonna pay out $25 million a year to keep all your resources up to date. Now, so your spend was $130 million a year. Now your spend is $25 million a year ongoing. You gotta spare $105. What can you do with that $105 million? I don't know, hire more teachers, more pre-K. There's need, right? It's not like we have too much money. And so we just have to be smarter with the money that we're spending. We it's not a lack of money problem. It's a inertia problem and an old business model problem.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Chair Reed, thank you. Very interested in the concept. I do have a question on peer review. What is the peer review process? How do you vet? Since it doesn't seem to be a competitive bid on price, which may be a good idea,
right?
May not be. I mean, that could be discussed further. But it seems to be a set price, and then you're asking for a product.
Yeah.
So there must be a peer review element to decide what is the best product.
That's right.
How is that done?
So it's done in two ways. First, the OER projects themselves run peer review processes. So, for example, in the Open Course Library, the process that we set up as we were building out our entire general education curriculum, first we put multiple faculty from different colleges on the physics team. So we had 10 faculty from 10 different community colleges on our physics team. So that in and of itself provided some different perspective in peer review. Then those courses had to be reviewed by two people outside of our system. Then we piloted the courses and got feedback from others and the students, and then we redesigned them based on that feedback. And here's the really exciting part of OER. When you open them up to the world finds bugs and errors in your work, and they tell you about it, right? So when we opened our courses and said, look, we didn't design these for Oregon. We did it for Washington State. If Oregon wants it, take it. And some Oregon, community colleges said, ooh, I like that course, and I like that course. But hey, Washington, you actually have an error here, right? So the public peer review is kind of ongoing, and those feedback loops come back. And before the Oregon Community College decided that they wanted to use it, they ran a peer review process, a quality process. So the short answer to all that is that ultimately it's the University of Oregon's responsibility to decide what's quality and what's not. You should never trust somebody else's peer review process. That said, big OER projects, every project that I've shown you today does run rigorous peer review processes. Does that help?
Yeah, and follow up,
please.
So it seems like if you put the project together for $1 million, but you have a 25% ongoing payment, that either seems like the project, I don't understand the scope of it yet, but it either seems like the $1 million is short, like they're doing that at a loss, or the 25% seems maybe a little bit high for an ongoing cost. Which is it? Is this kind of a loss leader to get into the contract to maintain it? I mean, are the private companies spending more than $1 million to develop the curriculum and have to have that ongoing peer review updating contract in order to make it work for them?
It's not a loss leader. It's simply a question of what the market can produce for what cost. And there's one of the interesting things about OER is that educators come to OER and act and build OER and share for very different reasons. So, for example, in the open course let me start with this. So this is the FET simulations that I talked about. This is the University of Colorado Boulder. This was started by Carl Wieman, who's a Nobel Prize winning physicist at UC Boulder. Carl won the Nobel Prize. He got his $1.3 million in prize money. He could have gone and bought a house and a boat and retired, right? He didn't. He said, I'm an educator. Education's about sharing. I want people to learn STEM, physics, biology, chemistry, et cetera. And this is my experience, how they learn it best. He took his $1.3 million and plowed it into this. Each simulation they build costs, give or take, $60,000-$70,000. That's just a market reality. That's how much it costs to hire good computer programmers and content experts to build these sims. How'd they get to $70,000? They simply said, look, we need to hire people to do X, Y, Z. How much is it going to cost? So the market reacted to that. As far as updates for these, a lot of times the updates are free. So let me go into this one, for example. So here's energy forms and changes. This is a simulation which students can manipulate that shows how, liquid changes to gas and changes to plasma, et cetera. If you scroll down to the bottom of the page, let me make this bigger so you can see it. You see all this? Arabic, Basque, Bosnian, Czech, Danish, Dutch. These are all translations of these simulations. This was all done for free. Nobody paid anybody to do that. Why did they do that? Because somebody in Bosnia said, look, I really want this sim in my language, and because this has a Creative Commons license on it, I can do it for free. And you can go down, and here are all the languages that these sims have been translated into, right? And I can run it in Turkish, and I can download it. So some people just do this for free. In the Open Course Library in Washington, I paid faculty a pittance, right? We carved out one-third release time for a year, tiny amount of time. I said to the faculty, please, do not write new open textbooks. I'm not paying you enough. I'm not giving you enough time. Five of them still built open textbooks because they were so angry that their students had to spend $175 in books, like you said. They were done with it, and they said, I'm going to spend my own time to do this because I'm an educator. Others feel it's a moral and ethical obligation to leverage the tools of the day to help people get an education. Others are in it for the money, to be totally frank. Others do it because they don't like inefficient use of public funds. That's frankly why I'm in it. It makes me slightly ill when the public spends 50 times for something that they could spend once for.
Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Gagos?
Yeah, I would just comment on that as well. I think that what frustrated me or frustrates me often is that I remember I used a Sony clip a few years ago, and in the Sony clip it was talking about how information is changing so rapidly, and that somebody going into an engineering program as a freshman, the whole literature has changed by the time they're a senior. And I get so frustrated having to buy a textbook every 2 years because of the updates, and this looks like it would make updating and so much cheaper and easier, I would think.
That's exactly right. And not only is it cheaper and easier, but you get to decide when you make the updates, right? So if you're a psychology professor and there's a new concept in psychology which you just saw at a conference, you don't have to wait. You can make that change in your course for Monday. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So I had two questions. One, you talked in pretty good detail about the cost of production and maintenance, but to what degree have different states taken that on in different ways? Does everybody have that same kind of model of RFPs? And maybe I'll just sort of combine my questions into one. The second one really is, given the range of things that other states and other locales are taking on. And I guess this is also a preview for the question to the folks from Chemeketa and Clackamas. What do you see as the unique role and thing that we ought to be doing in Oregon? Do we just need to go to the next courses that aren't already developed? Are there other niches that we should try to fill?
So policymakers can do several things. In Washington, the legislature said, how can we help? And we said, well, we need to provide, the faculty are all in, but what they need is time, and they need support. They need some help moving this direction. And the legislature said, what do you need? And we said, we need a little bit of money. We get it matched by Gates. We ended up with $1.5 million. We ran the open course library.
Right.
Right. So that was helpful. It was a very small amount of money from the legislature, huge impact. The legislature then required us to come back annually and report on what we were doing for OER. That's another thing you could do. I would recommend the legislature ask the universities and the community colleges annually to report on what they're doing with open educational resources and, as important, what they're doing to reduce the cost of instructional materials in their classes to improve access. That's an easy thing. It's a no-cost thing. Another thing that we did in Washington and everybody else is doing is to look at where there are existing laws on the books which may provide barriers to OER adoption. So, for example, in the state of Arizona, and this is common in many states, there are anti-bribery laws that take their form in anti-gift laws. So in Arizona, it's against state law to use state funds to give somebody a gift that's more than $5 in value. Well, as Arizona K-12 started to move toward OER, they were doing some smaller runs of open textbooks, printing them, and they cost $5.50 to print. And so it was violating state law to use district funds to print an open textbook for $5.50 and to give it to the student and say, please keep this, right? Build a library. And so by state law, they had to take those books back, even though financially they didn't need to or want to. And so it's worth doing an analysis to see if you have anything like that. In Washington, for example, there was a law in the books that said faculty in the state shall look at multiple commercial textbook options and consider cost when making a choice. We simply amended that law, so it said, and look at open educational resources and talk to your librarians as well. Right? Small changes, but very meaningful. Things like this help a lot, right? Having information sessions, bringing the college presidents, the university presidents here, and grilling them on this stuff, right? What are you doing around OER? Oregon State, for example, has an open textbook project out of the library where they're actually taking Oregon State money and they're funding OER to be built. It's a great project. You may not know about that. You should ask them for reports on that. And then you should bring University of Oregon here and say, why aren't you doing that? Sorry if there's anybody from the University of Oregon.
We shot out from all quarters.
That's okay. You don't have to apologize. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Reed. So I have a question on how this might interface with either charter schools, private education, and accreditation to the student. Has that been tackled with the open textbook concept that they say, okay, we want to use this curriculum,
right?
But we want to get credit for it, and we want that credit to be transferable to the next community college or next, you know, four-year education or wherever that they go.
Right.
What's happening in that arena with open education in charter, you know, or maybe not a traditional learning environment?
Sure. So a couple answers to that. First, to be very clear, when something has an open license on it, everybody can use it. Doesn't matter if you're public or private, it's open, right? Anybody on the planet can use it for any purpose. So if you build something for public, like the K-12 OER Collaborative is public institutions, the states coming together around their public schools, but charter schools can take all that and use it for free, and we hope that they do, frankly, and they're most welcome to. As far as accreditation and transfer, it's really the same answer as the quality question. So take transfer from community colleges to universities, for example. There are typically, traditionally, articulation and transfer committees where the community colleges and universities talk with each other, and they say, you know, for this course number, it's got this syllabus, we teach these learning outcomes, this is the textbook we use. Do you, Oregon State University, think this is okay, and will you take credit from Chemeketa when our students transfer? And they have that conversation. When you change the textbook, doesn't matter if you're changing from commercial textbook or you're changing from commercial to OER, that's part of that articulation and transfer conversation. In California, the community colleges moved very, very quickly into OER, and they didn't talk with the universities about it as they were doing so. And so there was a short-term hiccup with the Cal State and the UC system in California where they said, whoa, hold on a second, we're not sure we want to give credit because you just changed everything on us. But when they took a step back and looked at it, they said, well, you know, content is content. And yes, we still need to review it for quality and still need to review it for fit and make sure that people are still learning the learning outcomes that we need them to have before they come to university. But they just put that open textbook into the same articulation and transfer committee structure and reviewed it, as you should for quality, as you should for articulation and transfer. And either the OER stands up to that scrutiny or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you should throw it out or fix it so that it does. And so this was one of the lessons when I hate to bring up Schwarzenegger, but when Schwarzenegger was governor in California, he actually set up a process where he said in K-12, he said, look, K-12, this is crazy. Our materials are 10 years out of date. We're California. We have Silicon Valley. Why do we not have up-to-date educational resources? And so what they did was they have a very rigorous process where at the top of the funnel, publishers can throw in their textbooks, and there's a review about what meets California state standards for all the subjects, all the grades. And some of the books make it through that gauntlet. All that Schwarzenegger did was say, let OER go in the top of that funnel. It has to be held to all the same standards, same rigorous reviews, same quality reviews, and either it makes it through or it doesn't. The net result of that was very interesting. Some OER didn't make it through, some did. Some commercial content didn't make it through, some did. The difference was, and then it all got ranked by against the California state standards. So it was like on a 40-point scale. So, you know, textbook X from Pearson made it through, and it said, this meets 36 out of the 45 standards. Pearson's response to that was, good to know, we'll fix it next year. The OER content made it through, you know, 38 out of 45. OER's response to that was, we'll have that fixed in 48 hours, right? Because it's got an open license on it. And so it's fixed. Now it's 100% California state compliant, and it's free. Here you go, right? And that project, you can use all this, by the way, in your schools. This is called CK-12. This is, you all remember Sun Microsystems before Oracle bought them. So these are all the rich people that got bought out at Sun and made hundreds of millions of dollars in stock options. A lot of these people were of Indian descent who are VPs of Sun Microsystems. It's very strong in the Indian culture to have a good education for one's population. And so they decided the U.S. had been good to them. They wanted to give back. They set up CK-12. They've now got grades 1 through 5. Mostly what they have is high school, and these are all the subjects they've got. It's mostly around STEM. All these books are free. They're under a Creative Commons license. They're designed at the highest level of quality. And these were the books that went through the gauntlet in California that said, within 48 hours, we'll have updates for you. And so my advice to, if I was in front of your K-12 education committee, I would say, ask your K-12 districts, you know, why they're not using these chemistry resources, which are free and up to date, not 10 years out of date. And all of these resources, here's 5 digital versions. You want them print them out for $4 a pop.
One good piece of news is that you're in front of at least one person who is on that education committee, Representative Reardon. I think Representative Hayden had a brief follow-up, and then we'll come to you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Reed. So on your courses, two-part question. I'll try to be brief here. Is there an opportunity through your peer review system, which sounds pretty good, to kind of sticker some of these courses, maybe some of the simulations? You wouldn't say this is a credible, that you would accredit this course, but here's a course that we would recommend the option of accreditation for transfer, because transfer is an issue that we will be tackling that. I feel like at least we could have students be able to utilize their resources better, not run out of their Pell Grant if they get into starting to use this. Second part of that question, so first part is there any way your peer review could kind of take these as credible or not requiring institutions to accept them, but just kind of a here's a heads up that we think this might be something that you could give accreditation for. And the second part, or give credit for, second part of that is, if we are using the matrix of California or Washington or other states, does that drive, since those matrices are probably set by a political body, does that drive the content? Is there concern that that might drive the content one direction or another?
Okay, so great questions. So the first one, can the resources be tagged somehow to show quality and that they will certainly allow for transfer? Sure, but that's frankly a local or regional issue.
Sure.
So what Oregon considers to be of quality for transfer within Oregon schools is an Oregon decision. That's different than what California would do, is different than what Louisiana would do. Certainly some of your students do transfer out of Oregon community colleges to other states or other countries, and those transfers are important, but mostly what this legislature cares about is Oregon high school to Oregon community colleges to Oregon universities. Would that be true? Okay. Then what I would recommend you do is set up some kind of task force or committee that, or maybe task the existing articulation transfer structures to take on this issue. So to the extent that, let's say, Chemeketa, for example, gets big into OER, as they're talking about doing, that should be in the conversation. But honestly, if you care about that, that should be in the conversation now with publisher materials, because a lot of the publisher materials, if you talk with faculty, are not of high quality and may not meet articulation and transfer guides. So it doesn't matter if it's open or closed or expensive or free. These are, you're asking the right questions, and these are important quality and articulation transfer processes to get in place. I could do this on a global level or a national level, but frankly, Oregon would say, well, look, you were talking with Slovenia about what was high quality, and we don't really trust them, right? We're gonna have a conversation in Oregon. The second question about the matrices and the state standards, if you go to CK-12, for example, and you went in and you searched against their books, I'd have to pull it up here. I can come in here and say, pull down to Oregon, and it's going to say, well, for Oregon, you know, we've got these subjects against these grades. And what they've actually done is CK-12 has pulled Oregon's state standards for your K-12 curriculum, and they've modified their books to meet your standards. And they've published Oregon's state standards and the concepts in their books. And they've said, for this Oregon state standard for biology for grade 8, it's on page 26, 27, and 28 in this textbook. And why did they do this? Because they want you to use their books. They don't want your money. It's all free. This is a public service that they're providing because they believe that people should have up-to-date books. And so, for example, I mean, these are all aligned, these books, for 7th grade biology. So here's biology concepts, and if I come in, it's going to tell me, here's the book. They're downloadable as PDF, as MOBI, so MOBI is for your mobile phone, and as EPUB, which will play quite nicely on your iPads or your Kindles, and they'll give you a web version as well.
As long as Internet Explorer keeps working.
Yeah, if Explorer works. Sorry.
No, it's not you. It's probably us.
Yeah. and they even have they've got a tool called Flexbooks, which essentially lets your K-12 districts or your community colleges, because a lot of their books work really well for 100 level and especially Dev Math and Dev English courses, you can write on their platform, edit. So you don't like the order of the chapters? Move them around. You don't like chapter 2? Throw it away. You want to edit down to the sentence level? You want to move that image around? Go for it. They make it really easy to do so. And then you lock down the book and say, this is what I want for Salem School District. And you want to print it? They make it easy to do print on demand. If you have local bookstores or local businesses that can do the printing, keep the business in state. That's a good thing. Right. If you don't, Amazon will do it. We're happy to take your money up in Washington, and they'll print them for $3 a book.
Thank you. Representative Reardon?
Oh, just a very simple question. Are you signed up yet to address the Education Committee, the K-12
version? In Oregon?
Yeah.
I don't believe so.
I think you might have an idea for that, Representative
Reardon? I think I might. Okay. We should chat.
Okay. Very good. Other questions? Well, I imagine we could spend all the time we have continuing to ask you questions. You've been very patient with us, very helpful, and I hope we're going to keep in close touch with you. We're also fortunate to have folks from Chemeketa and Clackamas with us, so I want to bring them up and hear their reactions and more about what's happening in Oregon specifically. But Dr. Green, thank you very much for being here. I hope we'll be in close touch and we'll have a chance to try to put some of your ideas into action here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
This contract for you, have had contractors.
Yeah, maybe. We've got some ideas already. So Julie Huckelstein, Tim Rogers from Chemeketa. And as you get started, I should thank you for helping us bring Dr. Green here. That was a bit of great coincidental timing that allowed us to have this hearing today. So we're eager to hear from you as well.
Thank you, Chair Reed, and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here and being willing to listen to us today. As you can tell, from Dr. Green's remarks, you can understand why we wanted to bring him to Chemeketa to try to move our projects forward there. As you've heard earlier, there is a big issue about costs for textbooks for students and then all other course materials as well. And as a community college, we've long been concerned about those costs. And as you've also heard, there's a major barrier when it comes to those costs. And many of our students are part-time. So, for example, Chemeketa, that is here in Salem, Oregon, has about 36,000 students. About 20 of those are credit students, and the majority of our students are part-time. I forgot to mention that my name is Julie Huckelstein, for the record.
We were just debating. I was like, did she say it? Did she not? Thank you.
You're welcome. I think what I would want to focus on, because we have a limited amount of time, really is how I got interested in this. I heard about Dr. Green about a year ago at a college online distance learning project. And when we did that, I got very excited because at the time I was the vice president, and I thought, wow, you know, it's really important for us to try to bring that to Chemeketa. And so then I became president, and now that's been known as my initiative, and it's called the Textbook Sticker Shock Initiative at Chemeketa. And Tim Rogers, who is here with me, he's going to give you more details about what we are doing and what we hope to do in the future. What we've done primarily, though, is we brought a greater awareness to our college about the cost of textbooks with our faculty and others. In September, we called together a group and said, if you're interested in trying to reduce costs for students, please come to this session. And we were really pleased because we had 40 or 50 primarily faculty come because they said, it is not good that our students are going without textbooks. We also had a panel of students that shared that, and we only had 5 students on this panel, and we asked them what their experience was with textbooks and whether or not they actually had always purchased the textbooks and the materials that they needed. And four out of five of those students said they had gone without a text. And I think for the people that were in the room, which were all of our administrators, they were quite shocked about that happening. And when asked why they did that, they said, well, it was between buying a textbook or buying food or paying their rent. We also asked them, well, do you feel that your grades were affected by not having those materials? And all of them said, yes, they really did. And also, it has impacted their ability to complete their courses. One thing that I don't know if Dr. Green covered was a number of our students in community colleges need to take developmental courses. And so those courses are those courses that are pre-college courses. Those courses just have a number of materials as well, and they're high cost, and many students have to take those just to get to college level. So they not only have the college level courses that they have to have materials and texts for, but they also have to have those developmental. So that can add, for some students, that can add 8 more courses. So you can imagine when, if the average cost is $128, think about 8 more courses for those students. I think now, since I know that you're very interested in hearing about what we're actually doing and what we've done so far and what we hope to do, I'm going to go ahead and turn this over to Tim Rogers.
Thanks.
Okay. Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Rogers, and as Julie said, I'm here with the honor to tell you what Chemeketa Community College is doing to help control textbook costs.
Great.
And before I get into some of the actual projects, I would also like to say that Julie had mentioned we went to an OCC DLA conference and heard Cable Green. We've also been able to talk to colleagues in other community college districts. One notable one I know that has inspired me quite a bit was Maricopa Community College District in Arizona. And the thing that was really interesting about that, and I think that kind of made me more aware of the things we could do, is they started this project called the Maricopa Millions, and their goal was to save $5 million in textbook costs for students in their district over a period of 5 years. I continue to watch them since I've heard about this. They're on their third year. They're at $3.84 million as of my last check yesterday on how they were doing. And what I think inspired me the most about that is sometimes it's not a massive or big change that needs to be made to do that for students. This has all been accomplished by them in creating low to no cost textbooks in their 3 highest enroll courses in their district. You know, not 10 or 100, just 3. So it kind of sparked my imagination to think about what is it that we could do. Also, kind of to get things started, one of the things we've done at Chemeketa is to try to organize people around this concept. Having Dr. Green here is certainly part of that. Julie had mentioned that we had extremely good response from our faculty when we opened this conversation to them during our fall in service. And that interest has continued. So we started with a committee that's looking at the way we control textbook costs. But as we have conversations about OERs and rental programs and other things, more and more faculty keep joining. And the thing that we continue to see is that there's high interest in this. This is not an area where anybody seems to be digging in their heels, and they're all very willing to move forward with it. So it's very encouraging. So what I would like to do, though, is just take a minute to transition and tell you about some of the things we're doing. You've heard about OERs, but there's a lot of other things that colleges can do to help control textbook cost. And a lot of these happen through partnerships with our college bookstore, with our student retention areas. And I do want to mention that our bookstore manager, Meredith Schreiber, is here in the audience today. And she's going to hear me talking a lot about some of the great things that she has done in her time at Chemeketa. One of the first ones is that at Chemeketa, we have a price comparison system for students. So a student that buys a book at Chemeketa, when they go to enroll in the course, they have a link where they can see that what the textbook is that's used. But when they go there to learn more about the book, they don't just simply see Chemeketa Community College. The textbook is $128. They see what it is at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and BookBite and CourseSmart and Textbook.com and RedShelf. And they have electronic versions. They have print versions. Also, students have options to do things besides purchase the textbook. They can rent the textbook, and we've had a very vibrant rental program. In fall of 2014, about 45% of our textbook titles were offered for rent. As of this next term, spring of 2015, we'll have 76% of our titles that are available for rent to students. Also, as I mentioned earlier, ebooks is an option, and about 50% of our titles are currently available as ebooks, which immediately, even at the publisher prices, drops us at about 50% in cost. Also, we've done a lot of work with publishers, and they can move on their pricing. Sometimes it takes some work and some arm twisting, but you have to be very active to work with those publishers and get those prices down. Also, our math department has a long struggle with the cost of textbooks for our students. They've been able to work with Pearson to reduce the cost of some of our math classes by as much as 40% on new books and 60% on rental costs as well. Sometimes, even if you're using publisher-provided materials, the newest edition is really not necessary for teaching a class. So one of the things that Chemeketa also does is it seeks out markets for older editions of books so that we can make those available to students at a lower cost. And that also seems to help. And then also we do a lot of work with out-of-print text and other materials that could be available. Moving from the bookstore, looking at some other areas of the college, in our retention area, one of the things that we do is we run a student book exchange. And a lot of times there's kind of this secondary market for textbooks now through this that is student to student. So a lot of the used textbooks on our campus are not sold by our textbook. They're sold by other students directly. And in that course book exchange, we allow students to advertise what books they have for sale, and students can find avenues to buy those. This is also true of other materials for courses such as calculators. And then we also have a textbook lending library where we don't have an unlimited supply of texts, but students who have good academic standing, we usually want them to be at 2.75 or higher and have an academic plan, can actually come, first serve, and can have textbooks at no cost that we provide. One of the things, too, as I was listening to Cable talk that I thought was kind of interesting is there were questions about peer review and wondering, you know, if as we use other kinds of course materials, is this being looked at? And in our social sciences area, one of the things that they've started piloting is internal audits that not only look at an instructor who might want to use an OER, but it looks at all of the course material used for social science courses for alignment with course objectives. And, you know, at the end of the day, that's really what we're looking for, is the course that we've designed and the objectives that we have in place, does whatever course material that's selected meet those objectives? And having some of the programs much more active in that is another thing that then has brought up the issue of cost, because as they were putting all the information down about textbooks, we're starting to get a lot of robust conversations about, is $210 for a psych book really logical? And let's look at what other options we have. So it's kind of putting a spotlight on some of the issues. Our college library has been ramping up for about a year and a half to 2 years for the day when OER might be, we might see broader adoption of that at Chemeketa, and we've been creating some systems to house those materials, because one of the things that we've also wanted to do is to build kind of a community around this effort. So we have something called the Chemeketa Learning Cloud. It has library support. We have a person who we don't call an OER librarian, but that is really what she is in terms of her specialties in supporting this digital system for these resources. And then our distance learning and academic technology department has been offering a series of innovation grants to people who want to do upgrades and things to improve their courses. And one of the standout projects that we often see is people want to do OERs, or they want to modify OERs for use in their class. And so that's just been fairly popular. There was a question earlier also about, with textbooks, there are these secondary materials in terms of slide sets and labs and simulations. And one of the projects that we had in the innovation grant was to use some open source software to actually create information technology simulations for a CIS 160 class we have at Chemeketa, replacing a very expensive and separately licensed publisher resource for that. So several things that we have learned is that there is great enthusiasm for this, and there were people doing it before Julie set us on this course towards OER. And as we looked around and walked the aisles of our college bookstore, we would see these packets, which looked like about a ream of paper sitting on a shelf in a plastic wrapper. And as we tore those apart and looked into them, we realized that we had faculty that were already designing this type of material, that were basically self-writing, self-publishing textbooks. And it was great to see that. And some of these folks now are becoming champions that are joining us in this work and looking at how OER could be a potential. And a lot of these folks are on to not just one book, but have done two or three in some of the math classes. So, and that was one thing I wanted to make sure, too, that I said before we, before my testimony ended, is just keeping focus. I use the term course materials a lot in my conversation, just so that, now in 2015 we realize that a lot of the content is not necessarily in a textbook. So it kind of recognizes all those different formats. So I think one of the things I'd like to add to all the things we're doing, since I have these few minutes with you, is to tell you what I think we need help on. And one of the things that I hear all of the time as I work with this group of people is, if I only had more time, I would do this. And we hear, I have heard that probably six times this week in these conversations. And what it really comes down to is our faculty are going to be the people who are important to determine what the materials we use are and how they align with the course objectives. But what they need is the time to do that work, which usually means release time from the regular teaching load. And that is definitely a cost to a community college to have to replace those hours with adjunct instructors. But one of the things that is so evident to me, and is one of the things I thought of, there's this thing called the multiplier effect, that as I listen to cable talk and I see the numbers on spreadsheets about how much money would save students, I know that that investment, whatever it is, would grow 10, 20, 40-fold in the process in terms of savings for students and reducing the cost of their education. So that's an area that I think that we could use help. And for that help, I know at least at Chemeketa what we would look at doing is to try to first look at courses for OER development that fit the AAOT track. So the most common courses, those will be like when Cable was talking about the top 100, we have, even we took our top three or four, and we were just running numbers last night, and it was running in a quarter of $1 million per class per year. So we would target those classes. And then, as was mentioned earlier by Julie, the developmental courses are so important. And we price students who are not college ready out of the college market. If you do have to take eight classes and you do have to buy the textbooks that are aligned with that, one time I ran the numbers and found that just for a student coming in at the lowest levels of math on the student placement test, if we put them through the whole program of courses with textbooks, it takes $2,600 to get them college ready in math alone. And that just seems like a cost that students can't bear. So we will definitely want to target those courses. Also, anything that we develop, we would intend to put a Creative Commons CC BY license on, which is what Cable was telling you about earlier, so that this can be shared across the state and beyond with other colleges. And we would also work to make students aware of what those low-cost alternatives were, as you also heard earlier, the value in letting people's feet vote. So that's basically the end of my testimony. And if you have any questions.
Thank you. I know Representative Gallegos had a question, then we'll go to Representative Nierman.
Yeah, I just, you mentioned the software issue, and I know that the in social sciences we used a lot of SPSS materials, and those licenses were quite expensive, and they had to be renewed and new versions and so on. So I'm assuming that's, and I was thinking mainly about STEM kinds of courses where we really do need some of that supplemental software. So I'm assuming that is available as well.
Sometimes it is not specifically available, already packaged for that, but one of the things, as with our computer information systems course, sometimes there are the toolkits to develop those things, and those are available as open tools.
Representative Nierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'll ask this question of both you, and then I'll give Dr. Green a chance if he wants to come back with the indulgence of the chair. But we talk around this table a lot about CTE and workforce development, and yet all the textbooks that I saw up there were kind of, and I get it that you're going after the big courses that everybody's got to take, English and all that. So is there any dental hygiene, or I don't even know if you use a textbook in your welding classes or whatever, but can you talk to that a little bit?
Question.
Yes, Chair Reed, Representative Nierman. One of the things on that I would say, we had a conversation about this just yesterday, interestingly enough, and with some of the CTE areas, there's such specificity about what's being taught. If you're in a welding class, an automotive class, a machining class, a lot of times the text has to line up with the specific equipment that's being used, and sometimes there's even kind of a manufacturer twist on that. And so it does make some of those courses kind of challenging, but in general, I know that we've been looking more at the general education courses, just as you brought up. One, for that's where the numbers were and kind of the biggest gains are, and I think there are those complications around some of the CTE areas. But
so the $2 billion from the Department of Labor that I talked about, where they required an open license on everything that was built, those are all career and technical pathway. The whole point of that $2 billion, it came out of the Trade Adjustment Act, and the idea of the grant was to put Americans back to work who'd lost their jobs, either to overseas competition and outsourcing, or to the 2008 economic crisis. And so all of those academic programs, and they're in all 50 states, at 800 community colleges, $2 billion worth of new content, all openly licensed. They're all exactly those pathways. And in fact, the Department of Labor now with education is launching a new project called the Online Skills Academy. And the idea is to take all of that OER that was funded by the TACT grant, or the Department of Labor grant, and other OER, and to create curricular pathways, non-traditional pathways, for students who a bachelor's degree may not be their goal, but they really want a job, and a good paying job at that, and to develop pathways that are both OER, but are also potentially have new forms of accreditation around them. So, yes, still accredited within the traditional accreditation systems as we know them, but you may have also heard the term badges before. There's new experiments around what somebody knows, how you assess that they know what they know, and then putting a smaller credential on it, and then those stackable credentials, which are common in workforce development, are stackable badges. And so a big play was just made in the Open University in England, which has about 250,000 online students. They're now rolling out badges for their workforce development students, and they're working with the Fortune 500 companies to say, if our students have XYZ degrees and certificates from our traditional institutions and these badges that they've accumulated through these OER pathways, will you give them a job? And you know, if you're a business, you want people with the right skills who can do the work. The other quick answer is somebody asked about SPSS. Type in open source SPSS. IBM put one out called PSPP, and it's an open source alternative. Doesn't cost anything. It's open source software.
Nice.
Can I follow, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
So thanks for your presentation, all of you. And that was the right answer to the question, by the way. But I have to tell you, I'm a software engineer, and so I work with open source software a lot. And it constantly amazes me how, you know, I'm skeptical as the quality, because I work for a company, and we get paid to write software, and how expensive it is to write software. And I think there's no way that people are just going to, chumps are just going to come up and do this on their own, and yet they do.
Technical software term, chumps.
Yeah, chumps, whatever. But I'm constantly amazed, and even to the point where, I think I'm correct if I say this, is you can't even pay for a scripting language anymore. There's only open source, because they've driven that out. And I think and I hope not. I work in a Microsoft shop, so I'm a C# guy. But almost to the extent where open source is almost driving out the object-oriented languages too. I see someone nodding there. Whatever. So that means I'm going to have to get smarter and learn some more stuff. But the point is that the ability of the marketplace to respond and to produce quality stuff. I believe in that, just from what I've seen in the software development there. So I think that's possible. Anyway, that's just a comment. But.
Thanks. Mr. Rogers, I wanted to ask one question. You mentioned looking at sort of the top courses in terms of volume. Have you also had a sense of the degree to which the relevant, not that you've necessarily made a decision yet, but relevant OER already exists on someone else's library?
Yes, Chair Reed, there's a bit of work going on that now, although we're still fairly young in that effort. But it's interesting that our highest enrollment classes are writing and math. I think where that's happening the most right now at Chemeketa is in the math area. They are looking at currently generated OERs and seeing what of those could potentially help, especially in the developmental math courses.
Yeah. So the reason I'm asking, just for the committee's benefit too, and obviously you figured this out, if we're trying to figure out where we as a state can make the best and biggest difference, it might be just in the capacity to do that sort of work and maybe not as much in having to create new OER. It seems like there's a good chance that the top classes in Oregon already have, there are things from which to choose that have already been developed elsewhere. So it sounds like you're confirming that?
Yes.
Okay, good. Any other questions for this panel? I guess I'd say, please add Powell's to that list, the cost comparison tool you
I
have.
I did, yeah. I was thinking
local
too.
Bookstore, too.
Yes.
Like that idea.
They print things very quickly.
Yeah. Good. Thank you very much. We'll ask President Truesdell and Jill Freeman from Clackamas to join us now.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joanne Truesdell. I'm the president of Clackamas Community College. And joining me today is Jill Freeman, our department chair for instructional support and professional development. Many of the really cool things have already been said by Cable and by President Huckestein. So just a couple of things around workforce. In fact, Clackamas Community College was a statewide lead for a TACT grant through round one. All of the career pathway material, all of the career development material, all the coaching material was required to have CC BY. It is all on Creative Commons. Clackamas also is participating as the curriculum writer for what's called the Act On grant, which is all around retail, and all of that material is in the final review stages to be also posted online. Clackamas, I'm into my ninth year there. About 8 years ago, as the economy was really going south, and we were experiencing extreme declines in our revenue, laying off faculty and staff. One of the things that our faculty and myself had a conversation around is if we needed to raise revenue, and that was through forms of tuition to stop students from experiencing no pathway to a degree, we needed to control costs in other areas for them. And the biggest way we felt we could do that would be through influencing textbook opportunities. One of the many of the things that Tim Rogers talked about, we've also mirrored, but our next piece through the years was really on open educational resources. At the time, we didn't call it that. We just called it alternative. Our English faculty were the first to really think through what could be to not have a text in English. And this was before the OER opportunities through Creative Commons and actual textbooks. And our biology faculty actually took General Biology 101 and redid it to where everything was electronic. What I found for students, just anecdotally, what I found, one of the largest calls that comes into my office in complaints is around math textbooks. Students at community colleges who are attending part-time, everything from from a shift change to a change in marital status to a change in employment status can throw you in a course or out of a course very quickly. And what our students actually experience more is they get thrown out of a course for reasons that are not about them and their desire. There's no place for the textbook to go back to, and by the time they enter back in, it's out of date, a new textbook's been developed, and they have to pay yet another $150 for it. And that's untenable. So what we've done as we've started to reinvest, so just in fair disclosure, this year we are looking at a $550 million floor for the Community College Support Fund, which allowed us, so that's what we're budgeting on.
There are three members of this committee that are part of the Ways and Means Committee, so we appreciate that.
I'm as a floor.
Thank you.
We actually have invested in a librarian position that is currently under review to figure out how best they can help us. We do not have a lot of librarians at Clackamas for a college our size, and we need one to help with this OER procurement. But more importantly, and why Jill's here, is we really had started to think about bringing faculty in, new faculty, as we continually have more faculty coming in who are brand new, how to educate them, acculturate them, and help them get the skills they need to manage in this new educational environment, which includes OER. And that's what I really want to have you listen to Jill about.
Great. Thank you.
Chairman Reed, thank you for having me, members of the committee. My name is Jill Freeman. I'm a faculty member and the department chair for instructional support and professional development at Clackamas, which means I get to work with faculty to improve our educational outcomes, improve curricular quality, and make sure our students are successful in and outside the classroom. So OER is an issue that is deep to my heart. I also have 15 years of experience as a faculty member at Portland State and in community colleges and a media studies background. So OER in particular as a digital format, I think offers a lot of promise for us. There are really three things that we're doing right now at Clackamas to help shepherd in this movement and support our faculty, but we do need more support and help. The first is we're developing a first-year experience for new full-time faculty that are coming in, which with much of that work being able to be parsed out across part-time faculty and existing faculty members in terms of support for how to invest in and develop open ed resources for their classes. In addition to that, we're going to actually use OER as our curriculum tools so that faculty can experience that from a student perspective as well and become comfortable navigating those systems so that it becomes less daunting, because it really is a time commitment and a new way of experiencing education for our faculty, a lot different for many of them from what they experienced in their own educational paths. So providing that support is one thing we're working on. The other thing that we're doing is we're forming PLCs or professional learning communities for faculty so that they have a space to get together and communally discuss how they're using resources in classrooms. Textbooks are just one form of OER, and being able to use multimedia, digital technology, things that are more applicable to the audiences they might be experiencing in their classrooms provides needs a community of support, both in how do we use this, what are the most effective ways to use this in an educational environment, and then how do we do things like ensure that quality is being upheld in these materials and that we're meeting our learning objectives and outcomes. The thing that's really exciting for me about OER is that it's not just about these materials, because a textbook is not our content. It's not our curriculum. This provides us with an opportunity to have more discussions about how to really improve educational quality, because we're looking at ways in which we can personalize learning for students by borrowing, like Cable talked about, from multiple perspectives. We're really able to create a much more robust and diverse curriculum for our students, which is often much more reflective of where our students actually are. The final thing I just wanted to mention is that we're working with our OCDELA group, which is the Oregon Community College Distance Learning Association, which has been a great resource. And this year they have funded a one-year OER librarian who happens to be in the audience, Amy Hoffer, who is a great resource because she's able to sort of keep an eye on the state level as to what's going on and connect us. So that piece where not every college has to develop the same materials over and over again, this sort of position helps facilitate that. And she's also able to come to our campus, she's coming tomorrow for lunch, and consult with us about how to best shepherd in these sorts of opportunities. So having that kind of support is really, really helpful. The other thing I would say is that community colleges and four-year universities have very different needs, and so making sure that those needs are supported appropriately, that the DevEd needs of the community college, that the population needs of the community college are also represented in the kind of support that you're offering as the state, in addition to four-year universities. So
great. Thank you. Representative Rudin, and then Representative Wood.
Well, this is one example of why I so enjoy working with people from the community colleges, especially Clackamas Community College. I'm just wondering your...
They happen to be in your district, do they?
Well,
that was a
pretty
bias.
Close. Pretty close. Have these open resources, have they helped you work with that very diverse community that you work with? Are your students using books in different in languages other than English, for example, or is it?
I think so. There's the translation issue, which Dr. Green talked about, and that's a really beneficial thing for our students who are non-native speakers and our English language learners. And so our DevEd group that is working on redesigning our state curriculum has an opportunity to create developmental ed resources that are translatable. I think the other thing that's really interesting, though, is for students with learning disabilities, OER provides a tremendous opportunity to put things into multimedia formats and to really look at student learning preferences. And having an opportunity to access those materials in multiple ways, I think, is super beneficial for students.
Representative Wisden.
Thank you for your presentation. When you advertise a course to students, do you put on there textbook free or note what the textbook, so the students have a, they're the buyers, so they have a that input when they make their decision? I'm sure social media, that word gets around, but do you?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, not yet. And our biggest issue is, on the other hand, we also have to, we're not as far along in our general software development for students, so we're not communicating in that way. We're investing resources to make that possible. So we're in the process of it, but it's not yet. We hope to, a nice goal at Clackamas Community College that I'd like to see is perhaps in 10 years, we're not having a discussion about the expensiveness of textbooks for any of our courses. Five, I'd love that. I could go beyond $550 in order to make that a real reality.
We're going to vote for that.
But it is a, it's exciting.
And I think the social media point that you made is important. Students are talking about this, and the more we can give students a language to talk about this by working in our DevEd courses, by talking to new faculty who are coming in, giving students the tools to ask for these things so that they can also walk with their feet. I'm not sure. I gather that you teach, and so you have probably been on Rate My Professor maybe occasionally. Yeah. Not looking at yourself, of course, looking at other people. But I have seen myself on RateMyProfessor.com. And I won't encourage you to look at all of the comments, only the ones that have the green smiley face next to them. But students comment on textbook costs on those comments. And it's one of the things, students are crowdsourcing their information more and more. And so they're listening to each other. And faculty have started advertising when they make flyers for courses on our campus. While it's not in the catalog, faculty will mention if it's a low-cost textbook course on the flyers for students.
You're right. Representative Gallegos is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Portland.
Oh,
it has a question, but it sounds like you wanted to say something first, President Schuster.
No, it's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you. I mean, computers are so ubiquitous, and I just assume everybody has one. But is that an issue that we need to be concerned about in terms and just in terms of internet? Who pays for internet service, particularly with low income and folks? Is that something we?
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gallegos, the most important thing we can do is we really are trying to tackle two issues. One is the whole digital divide notion. If you can afford it, you have it, and if you can't, you can't. And so I see this as kind of a two-step approach. If we can save money by creating a different method of having freer access to educational resources and provide an intermediate standpoint of a very inexpensive print copy, we could divest, or we could invest then some of those resources to ensure that all of our students have on checkout or in a laptop, a mobile device to actually provide them with the tools they need to be continually learning in the 21st century. So I see it as it's an opportunity for us to really redirect where our resources are going to those things that actually add more value to students.
And I think also the bring-your-own-device culture that is starting in classrooms, tablets, phones. What we know is students use their phones for a lot of this. It's not, if you have eyesight like mine, it's not the best possibility for students, but it is making this sort of material, I think, more and more accessible. But there is a digital divide issue that we need to address.
Yeah. Very good. Unfortunately, we are coming near the end of our time, but I really appreciate you,
Thank you.
Helping
Thank
us
you.
Understand it. The other good news, both for your benefit and for the committee's reminder, we wanted to take advantage of Dr. Green's presence, so we had this hearing today. Next week, a week from today, we have a couple of bills on this topic. I suspect there's an advantage to having that time for us all to go and explore the various sites that we've learned about today and other sources so that we're even more informed for the conversation about those bills next week. We welcome any of you back if you're available then.
Great. Mr. Chair, may I just say one last thing?
Yes.
And that is that I do want to leave us with the notion that an open educational resource that can also be available in print format is the type of resource all of our students can have access to and have a need for. Even 18-year-olds like to feel and touch things and put a highlighter to it. Even 25-year-olds like things on an e-reader. Every 62-year-olds like it on an e-reader. I think that this is an opportunity for us to really rethink how everyone has an accessibility issue for learning, regardless of who they are. And I think that's what's exciting about OER.
I do too. It's a great note to end on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the informational hearing and ask if there's anything else to come before the committee. If not, Friday morning we have quite a busy agenda on bills, I think.
Yes.
We'll see you then. Thank you. We're adjourned.
So we got the amendment first.
Yes. Yep. So we'll be able to move that out. Yep. So we'll be able to move that out.
The amendment first.
Yes.